Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 15, Teacher Recruitment and Retention with Professor David Egan.
Welcome back, everyone, to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a returning guest for this episode, Professor David Egan. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, I'm good.
Now, we had you on, gosh, a few seasons ago.
Yeah.
Now, where we had a really interesting episode on the poverty gap and, you know, that knotty issue. Ooh. And we've got another knotty issue to get you in to discuss today. I've got in front of me here the fully published initial report of the Secondary Recruitment and Retention Research Project. And I suppose before you tell us about this, we ought to know, you know, who commissioned this? Why now? What's the sort of context that this was born out of?
Thanks, and thanks for inviting me back. And there's not a disconnection, we may touch upon that, between what I was here talking about previously and what I'm here talking about today, because like everything in education, they all interlink, don't they? Who commissioned it? Well, I suppose it was our now Vice Chancellor, actually, who, when I returned from a secondment period in Welsh Government, said, David, you know, we need you to look at the issues around recruitment, around secondary recruitment in particular. And obviously our then Dean, Julia Longville, was part of that conversation as well. But when we had an initial discussion, I think we agreed immediately, which was good, that you couldn't look at this in isolation. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't say, oh my goodness, we've got some challenges with recruiting to our secondary courses. To a lot of our secondary courses, let's be honest, isn't it? So we've got some problems there, and those problems are not Cardiff Met problems. Those problems are sector-wide. They are UK-wide. They're, to some extent, international-wide. So nothing sort of very Cardiff Met-y about that. But we agreed that looking at that without looking at retention issues in school, which, again, there was a wide awareness that that's a major kind of pressure for us at the moment. And then casting it more widely and saying, what's our ambition for this profession? You know, if we're going to talk about what seems to be a kind of glass half full, ooh, we got problems with recruitment, ooh, we got problems with retention, then let's start trying to fill the glass and think about what's the vision we have for this profession going forward in Wales.
And I suppose with your researcher hat on, you probably had some good ideas about how to go about investigating this and who to go to. So just briefly, how did you go about doing this research and who were participants?
Well, our first thought was that we would kind of look to lead it from Cardiff Met, but that we would then immediately make Welsh Government aware that we were leading it from Cardiff Met, and then we would try to bring in the rest of the sector in Wales. And we did try that. Both in terms of Welsh Government and the rest of the sector. And it looked for a while as if that might be the way that we would go forward. But it didn't in the end, for reasons that I won't go into now. But our part, in a sense, of the whole kind of issue, it didn't pan out like that. And it became very much a Cardiff Met project. And so I was able then to reach out to colleagues and get some interest from colleagues who were an interesting bunch because, in the main, they weren't coming from an IT background. So again, I should give credit to those. Laura Rhys-Davies, who you know and is one of our, you know, sort of much respected colleagues. And Laura comes from a kind of psychology background, but she has this very strong interest in coaching and mentoring. So she brought that to the table. Kate Hatfield, who again comes from more a kind of health, social care type background, but has a strong interest in everything to do with education and is a very lively character, as you know. And Kate came with her kind of perspectives, which was great. And then more latterly, Catherine Young, who does have a bit of a teaching background. She was one of the first Teach Firsters in Wales. I worked with her in the first cohort of Teach Firsters in Wales, and she was a teacher of Welsh and modern foreign languages. But she's now a colleague in speech and language therapy, basically, down in Llandaff. So Catherine came on board as well to help us with the Welsh medium issues. And then we did get some small financial support from Welsh Government that enabled us to bring in some research assistance help. So that was the team. And then basically we said, right, we're going to kind of talk to anybody and everybody that we can, all the obvious people, and we'll survey everybody that we can think of. So you kind of think of somebody who would have something to say about this, and we try to survey them. So that's how we said. And we did a big literature review, of course. Yeah.
Thank you.
We hear a lot about recruitment challenges, and like you said, it's particularly in secondary. And you can see in the report, you've sort of split it up into, well, first of all, you've got to recruit people to learn to be a teacher. Then you've got to recruit people into jobs. Then you've got to keep them in those jobs. And there are challenges all along the way, really. But just for any listeners, because we've got listeners outside the UK, we've also got a kind of group of our listeners who are maybe aspiring to be teachers, but don't necessarily know the sort of ins and outs of the profession. What is the situation in secondary? How sort of challenging is it? You've said it's a challenge. Have you got any kind of killer facts for us on that?
Well, I think we show in the report that virtually every secondary subject area now outside of physical education, and probably my own subject area, history by the skin of its teeth, is now not recruiting to target. And in some cases, the under-recruitment, which is historic. I mean, you know, 20 years ago when I was the head of school here, the dean as it is now, we were struggling to recruit for Welsh, for physics, for maths, and so it's grown. They've never, ever not been an issue, and then it started to move into English and then into geography and so forth, and then design technology and so forth. So the extent of it is, you know, and the figures are in the report, the extent of it is significant across the sector in Wales. Cardiff Met does well by comparison to other institutions, and we should blow our trumpet, why not, in that regard, but again, we're not meeting our targets outside of those subjects that I've mentioned. But it is a UK issue. It's not as if when you look around the UK, things are any different, even in terms of very strong institutions like UCL and, you know, Durham. Again, all of these institutions are facing similar problems to our own, which is kind of reassuring but worrying. Because, of course, the labour market is an England and Wales labour market. To some extent, it's a UK labour market for teaching. And then we've discovered, yes, that these are very much global, international issues as well.
And I suppose there's the Welsh medium issue as well in Wales, isn't there? Once you start really digging down into some of those shortage subjects like physics, for example, and you find out how many teachers we're creating as a country who can do that in Welsh, we're down to low single figures per year, I think, in some cases, aren't we? And those kids need to have a teacher-shaped body in front of them.
Yeah, well, it's again, one of those kind of gaps, isn't it? That, you know, the Welsh medium sector is growing apace. In some parts of Wales, Welsh is the natural language of the school. They are facing shortages, both in secondary and primary. This is where, again, things stray into primary. It's these issues are not. They're most acute in secondary. Come on to retention. It's a slightly different picture. But you can't exclude primary from these conversations, because once you get into that naturally Welsh-speaking part of Wales, then they are facing recruitment problems at school level. Once you then start getting into the Welsh medium sector across secondary and to some extent primary, then you're facing, yeah, some of those acute problems. So it's almost as if we need teachers, but where we need teachers the most, which is in the Welsh medium sector because it's a growth sector, and in our most disadvantaged context, the bridge from our previous conversation, because we know that teachers can make the biggest difference of all there in terms of moving those young people forward in their education. Good teachers, they are the schools that struggle to recruit the most. Some of them seem to have given up trying to recruit, actually, which is very worrying.
And that's a really interesting part of the report and its findings. If we focus on recruitment into ITE, you had some really interesting findings about what is drawing people into the profession and also signposted to some of the things we were sort of missing a trick in how we're promoting the profession, particularly with that sort of social justice sort of dedicated to working in areas of deprivation. And I just wonder, you know, at this point in time, you know, paint a picture for our listeners. What did the sort of ITE student teachers tell you about what drew them in or what would have drawn them in? Or
well, I think as we reflect in the report, Emma, really, that's one of the things that seems fairly constant. I mean, you know, again, you can get into a kind of glass half full space. We did a previous piece of work a few years ago for the Education Workforce Council on graduate entry into teaching. And we spoke to a lot of undergraduates, particularly in Cardiff University. And it was a pretty bleak picture, really, where, you know, their experience was secondary education, what their teachers had told them, what their parents had told them, what their parents who were teachers had told them was don't go there, basically. But then when you look more broadly at the research, then Generation Z, or is it Z, showing my age, you know, basically say, well, no, we're interested in careers in places like education or social work where we feel that we can make a difference, where we feel we can pay back something to society for the opportunities we've had. So those attitudinals don't seem to have changed all that much. I think what we're not doing, clearly, in secondary, because a lot of those people might be then disappearing into primary, no harm in them doing that, but what we're not doing in secondary is persuading them that that's a place where they can make that difference, you know. Mm. Develop their futures and their careers and so forth. So I think that's the picture. Yeah.
It's an interesting profession, isn't it, in that everybody thinks they have experience of it because they've sat in a classroom with a teacher in front of them. I mean, we had Dr. Emily McLeod on a little while ago who's done some research into this, and she was saying that they've seen the sort of, you know, from the audience thing, they have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. It also seems to be a profession that gets a really bad media profile. It's quite rare to get positive stories. And I often find myself wondering why it is sold so badly as a profession. I also wonder, has the post-COVID thing bitten, as in people expect to be able to work from home a couple of days a week, and now, you know, you can't do that in school so much?
Well, I think that, you know, there are sort of a number of major areas that come out of the research, really, and this whole thing about perception. And that perception linked to kind of workload and working conditions, because they're all in the same territory, really. Mm. You know, oh, why would you go into teaching? You know, the kids are rebellious. They're getting worse, kind of thing. We were saying that when I first became a teacher, but seems to be constant. And the parents are even worse. No, I mean, and you know, it, the workload is impossible. Working conditions are extremely challenging. So I think that kind of perception of teaching and the kind of perception that there is perhaps in the media, quite a few of the schools that we visited and the head teachers that we interviewed and teachers that we interviewed saw that as being a major problem. That kind of the stress, the challenges that they were facing, all of that was contributing to making schools appear as if they weren't very pleasant places, secondary schools in particular, very pleasant places to work. However, and that's the kind of, again, the interesting thing about primary, whereas recruitment is clearly a problem in secondary, retention in early career is a problem. Retention in primary in early career is even more of a challenge. So you see, I think this is where this is not about one part of the teaching profession. It's about the teaching profession as a whole. So a local head said to me when they've developed sociology as a kind of GCSE subject, and when they surveyed the sociology year 10, year 11 group, a very large number of them wanted to go into teaching, but then a very great proportion of those wanted to go into primary. And it's almost as if that's where they have those nice remembrances. Mm. That's where they have this kind of warm feeling. But when they end up, by the look of it, in primary, a lot of them find the workload and the well-being issues there as challenging, if not more challenging, than in secondary, and then retention becomes a problem.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about this sort of joined upness that there really ought to be from ITE all the way through to, you know, the report talks a lot about workforce development and progression, like how can I earn more money, or how can I continue to get satisfaction and continue to learn in my role as a teacher, as you know, throughout my career. And it's always been a sort of bee in Tom and my bonnet about the fact that we train our student teachers, they come to us for ITE, and then we have very little to do with newly qualified teachers. We look across the border to England, where they've got a two-year commitment to early career teachers, and this seems to be sort of more in place to ensure that there is that more seamless transition from ITE to those all-important ECT, NQT years. And I wondered if you know, did that come up as part of the problem? And do you feel that there are things that we ought to be prioritising to make that transition and to make that sort of joined upness better?
Yeah, I think that's bang on, Emma. I mean, I think it's perhaps one of the major things that comes through the research. But as you say, it's not something that we didn't know already. And that is, some people come on to a one-year PGC programme and they fly. And they fly. And it's kind of, can be quite annoying sometimes, doesn't it? Even for us, you know, because we remember what it was like, you know, to go through initial teacher education programs. But they do, they fly. And that's fine. As long as they end up in a positive space and they get the right kind of modicums of support, then they'll go on and have the career they want to have. But I think for the majority, it's much more, as we call it in the report, and I'm very attached to, a long, thin process of development. And that's why I've moved to thinking much more. I was quite happy to move from ITE to ITT to ITE. I was very content with that. And it was great that sort of post-furlong, because we'd been trying to move in that direction, because I think nomenclature is important. I see this is kicking up now as an issue in England. Tanya Overton-Hope has been raising it recently. About what should we call teacher training? Well, I think the answer was, at that time, teacher education. But I think now it should be teacher education and development. We should see this as a long, thin process of creating the future teaching profession we need. And that should be part and parcel of marketing it, selling it, and moving it forward. Mm. Yeah.
Just while we're talking about workforce development and all of that, I'm just going back to that whole social justice angle and just looking at the flip side of it for a second, because I completely agree that, you know, most people that are in teaching are probably like me. I was in teaching because when I, you know, went to bed at night, I wanted to feel I'd done something useful in my day and not something, you know, that was just sort of filling somebody's bank account or something like that. But when we spoke to Emily McLeod a while ago, she said there was this really interesting thing she found in her research where people felt they had to rewrite history, that even if they hadn't always wanted to be a teacher, once they went into teaching, they had to rewrite the whole of history and tell this story about how they'd always wanted to be a teacher. And there's this kind of, I don't know, does the teaching profession shoot itself in the foot with this need for social justice purity, where we could never say, well, actually, some people might be motivated by money, and is that okay? Some people might be motivated by nice working conditions, and is that okay? No, because we all have to don our hair shirts and be more social justice-y than the person next to us. And do we lose out as a profession on a whole bunch of people because we're just trying to be too holy than thou too much of the time?
I think it's an interesting standpoint. I mean, it seems to me that if you believe, as we believe, that teaching is the greatest profession, then you would want it to be attractive on a number of counts. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that again, and it's in the report, that as much as you would expect most teachers to say, we ought to be paid better, actually, that wasn't the strong part of the conversation that we had. And in some cases, head teachers were prepared to say, well, actually, it's not a badly paid profession at all. It's not, you know, of course, we earn every penny. And of course, we should have proper progression, proper salary progression. But the issue has become much more about the kind of working conditions, about that flexibility of employment that you were talking about feeling that you're valued and you're respected and that that is enunciated. You know, there's quite a strong piece in the report there about the importance of leadership in all of this. You know, that you tend to find, I mean, the research has shown that some interesting research going on at the moment that Education Endowment Foundation are doing in this kind of area in the most disadvantaged context is that retention is best in those areas where leaders are very proactive with their staff in giving them the opportunities we talked about, in praising them, in giving them the best kind of working environments that they can. So I think it's about, first of all, making sure that it's a reasonably well-paid job where you get as much support and nourishment and opportunities that you have, but also encouraging what seems to be that natural kind of tendency of people coming into teaching to want to make a difference. Now, that will get, you know, that will get smooth, perhaps, you know, over time. Some people will not lose that motivation, but it shouldn't be, I think you're right, Tom, the only thing that justifies us putting people into sometimes the terrible working environments that they are. You know what I'm talking about. You're in and out of schools as much as I am. And sometimes they're not great working environments. They're not great environments for anything. And in the kind of, in the challenging circumstances that are faced in schools today.
Talking of challenging circumstances, I suppose you could say that post-furlong and reaccreditation, we've actually got a very aspirational, challenging view of what it is to be a teacher in Wales. You know, teachers are expected to be involved in research and inquiry. We talk about teaching as a master's profession. And with that sort of level of ambition, coupled with that, we saw the sort of reduction in the range of options for routes into initial teacher education. We also saw that programmes like the Teach First programme now left Wales. So you've got fewer options. You've got a really ambitious climate, a challenging climate, as you said, for some student teachers that can be really quite challenging. They need longer. They, you know, we've lost BA secondary. We had a really sort of thriving portfolio of BA secondary with QTS routes into teaching. And I wonder sort of in hindsight, have we got the right portfolio of options, routes into teaching for different types of people that would come, you know, we want to entice into the profession? Do they need more options?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And you know, you make the case very strongly for that in the report. And that was a very strong message coming through the data that we collected, that we need as many viable routes into teaching, because they've got to be viable. And there have been issues about some of the routes that you talked about there in terms of viability. Teach First was a very expensive program to run. What killed it off in the end were retention issues. Now, you know, there's a lot I could say about Teach First because I was there right from the start with Teach First. Perhaps I'll come back to that. But to stay on your major point, I mean, I think as many viable routes as possible, but there has to be a quality threshold. I think it's interesting about when you apply that quality threshold. Mm. You know, I have a constant discussion with Esting colleagues about when do you make the judgment about quality. If you just make the judgment halfway through a PGCE course or halfway through a BA at primary course, I think you're missing the point, because the judgment ought to be in the second, third year of teaching. Have Esting ever looked at induction or the experience of newly qualified teachers? I've asked them this, so I know the answer. Do you see what I'm saying? You see, I think that what you're talking about, if you're talking about a long, thin development, then where you'll see the outcomes of a good ITE program as part of that teacher education development that I'd rather move towards is kind of at an appropriate point on the trajectory. And that's when you make the quality judgment.
Yes. I'm nodding vehemently here, David, because I have often felt that of course, we need to set a bar for qualified teacher status. But what it doesn't allow for is for you to sort of see variations in a student teacher's sort of exit profile. Certainly on our programmes, you can tell those who are starting to excel in certain areas, but the bar is you've all got to meet QTS. And so it can be quite challenging, I would imagine. And this is another part of the problem. I don't know because I'm not part of NQT, of the induction period, to determine what ex-student teacher who's left the PGCE programme will need in comparison to Y student teacher, right, because they've all gained qualified teacher status.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that, you know, because we've made this report sort of non-technical and therefore it's not sort of littered with the footnotes that normally I'd have in anything I write, I was very, very taken by Rebecca Allen's book, Rebecca Allen and Sam, what's his name? His name's gone for a minute. The Teacher Gap, where Rebecca Allen makes a very strong case there. When you look not just at the teaching profession, the research that's been done on teacher progression within the teacher profession, but also at other professions, and what tends to happen is that the growth spurt in competence, in quality, if you want to use that word, tends to happen sort of year 3 to year 7 to year 8. So in other words, what you're putting in place, whether it be a one-year course, a two-year course, a three-year course, a four-year course, is you're putting the foundations in to allow that later growth spurt to take place. And then that's when people really arrive at a kind of quality point where I think you could make a reasonable judgment. Now, some people will keep on moving forward from that, but the bigger spurt, and some people don't, the bigger spurt takes place in that period. It's common sense. If anybody's been a teacher, it's not just common sense, it's common practice, you know?
It made me think when I was reading it, because the report makes a lot of really ambitious suggestions and recommendations that over quite a wide range of things. We've talked about the sort of tension between you need people in rooms because there's 30 kids in that room and they need somebody with them. We've talked about some of the huge problems we've got with recruitment. Thinking to the future, I know it's been mentioned in episodes in this podcast almost kind of as a throwaway thing. You could imagine a future where the profession sort of bifurcates into a two-tier profession, particularly with how ambitious Curriculum for Wales is and what it asks of teachers and schools, where you end up with somebody qualified, perhaps in the very ambitious way that we do at the moment, who is going to be doing the curriculum design and the planning and the coherence and the equity and all the big sort of thinking stuff. And then a second tier, which, while it doesn't officially exist at the moment, may be existing in the shadows already of people who are not qualified, who are deliverers of stuff, who are perhaps given some basic behaviour management strategies and some policies and some materials. And then you end up with this sort of two-tier workforce. How close do you think we are to that? And if that were to happen, would that be a problem?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at outstanding foundation phase practice, and obviously that now is being swallowed up into Curriculum for Wales, then that's in a sense how the foundation phase kind of was meant to move forward, because the people who envisaged the foundation phase, including one of our own colleagues here at that time, Margaret Hanney, who helped, I lent her to the Welsh Government many, many years ago to help pull together the research that led to the foundation phase. Then people like Iram Siraj and Cathy Silver, you know, internationally respected researchers in that area, and Emma Jane Milton, who's now a colleague in Cardiff University, but worked on the evaluation of the foundation phase out of Cardiff Met. And they all saw the foundation phase moving forward with this ratio with the youngest children of, for every kind of teacher, there would be three support staff. There'd be six support staff. And for every teacher, once they got into the latter part of the foundation phase, that would go to 1 to 3. So that whole thing about early intervention, about having a workforce that could give that individual attention to children in terms of developing their reading and their oracy and all of those skills and the problem solving and everything that was in the foundation phase. That was the way we saw it. And when Iram Siraj came back and did a stock take of developments in the foundation phase, she found that the schools, in a sense, that were the furthest ahead were doing precisely that, where the teacher was becoming a kind of pedagogue, was becoming an organizer of learning within their schools, within their classrooms, and these well-qualified, so well-qualified
and teaching well-paid. Assistants.
Well, that's another issue. And the well-qualified, yeah. I mean, is another issue, isn't it? Because the number of schools that I've spoken to who've moved those teaching assistants, sometimes with very, very minimal initial qualifications, through the TA kind of accreditation process and then on to teacher training programs. So again, you know, that's a very accessy type way. But I think, yes, your fundamental point. And you see, I think there are things about pedagogy here that it's easy enough to focus, as I do a lot, on the quality of teaching. Because, you know, nothing for me trumps the quality of teaching. I don't like using that word, Trump. Nothing beats. You can edit that if you want.
It's staying in.
I just suddenly thought. But certainly, you know, teaching is tops for absolutely. But you see, what we always mean, if we mean good teaching, is good learning, don't we? You know, and that's why the Welsh would ask, you know, serves both purposes, you know, teaching and learning. And, you know, so if teachers are working, you know, at a high level of quality, then the pedagogy, the learning experiences of young people should be of the same commensurate quality. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we shouldn't be complacent about thinking that what we want, because we've got this deficit, we want to sort of top up the deficit and make the workforce as good as we can make it, and then everything will be fine and dandy. Because we know in all sorts of ways that learning is changing and schooling and education is changing.
I was struck by the bravery of some of the recommendations for change put forward in this report, not least the recommendation to scrap fees for ITE students. You mention in the report that we've had a bursary scheme for a long time, but largely it doesn't necessarily make a difference to the recruitment issues that we've got here in Wales. So I wonder what you anticipate Welsh Government will have to say about that recommendation.
Well, I think, you know, I think the writing's on the wall, isn't it? And I think what we try to say in the report, which is what the research, which has largely been done in England, we've been a bit shy of doing some research in this area in Wales, which is something that that Plaid Cymru have picked up on. They've constantly been saying to the Welsh Government, well, you know, you have these bursary schemes, why don't you do some research to find out whether they're effective or not? Mm. The research that has been done in England suggests, yes, they are a good recruitment incentive. You know, that people marginally, and we know the argument that sometimes people will go for a bit more money across the bridge to Bristol. We know all that. But that in the end, keeping those people in teaching, you know, we've got to be careful to say that those people, in a sense, are chasing the cash, not the career. I wouldn't go that far, because I think you'll probably find, again, we don't know, you'll probably find that a goodly number of people who have been recruited come in and they stay, or stay a reasonable amount of time. But I think that when you start looking in the long run, or the short to medium run, perhaps would be more accurate, they tend not to be there. Mm-hmm. And the worry, therefore, is that, yeah, they have chased the cash and loaded down with student debt. They've chased the cash, but they've not really had that long-term commitment to a teaching career. So I don't think it's been successful on balance, although, as I say, we do lack the empirical research to back that up totally. I was persuaded by somebody who knows a lot about these things, particularly coming from a kind of cost effectiveness, value for money, economist kind of view, that a cost benefit analysis of making some kind of offer to graduates. Now, you might start in the end having to think about the offer you make to 18-year-olds as well, if you're going to offer it to graduates, to be fair, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because student debt is accrued from both starting points.
Mm-hmm.
That making some kind of offer, actually in cost-benefit terms, I mean, the calculation goes, and we were going to do this work with colleagues possibly from our School of Management, but we decided that it maybe was a bit further down the road. But that what you would look at is obviously the money that is not coming into our sector, that could come into our sector, that is probably filling potholes somewhere as we speak, you know, in terms of the Welsh budget. You know, so that money's not coming into education. You'd look at the cost that schools are having to pick up in terms of supply teachers. You know, you'd look at it in the round. You'd look at it in terms of the improvement in educational standards that you'd hope that you'd get from that. You'd have to do quite a complicated cost-benefit analysis exercise, but that the case could be made that actually having a no-fee, reduced-fee kind of approach for graduates and possibly then for 18-year-olds might be a better way forward. And the person who told me this, who was in our roundtable discussion last week, I'm protecting his anonymity as I need to do, believes that England is not too far away from this. Now, if that happens, that's going to destabilise our market totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd rather see Wales get ahead of the game.
So a few things lined up in my mind when you were saying that, because I just reminded myself that we're talking about secondary in this report. And so far we've said secondary appears to be much less attractive as an option than primary. You know, people, for whatever reason, don't like the idea, lots of them, of being secondary teachers. It also lined up with about the two articles that our former colleague, Dr Judith Neen, former podcast fixture, came up with, one of which seemed to conclude that primary, with a few sort of caveats around subject specialism worries, were much more comfortable with the idea of curriculum for Wales than secondary were. Then she went on to write an article which said, and furthermore, secondary is so inflexible that it's actually very hard to provide the agency to do curriculum for Wales in secondary because it's so inflexible and all the kind of furniture gets in the way. You've also talked about foundation phase, you know, as being this, or foundation learning, as this new sort of model which has worked quite well. And I was sitting there thinking, oh gosh, I'm not actually sure how you do that with all the stuff that gets in the way in secondary. I found myself wondering, actually, secondary doesn't look radically different to what it probably looked like 40 years ago, 50 years ago, in some ways, in terms of the furniture, the structures.
Yeah.
Is it the secondary is as an age phase just hasn't moved with the times and is no longer fit for the times that we're living in, just the way it's constructed?
I mean, there are some very loud voices, and I understand, you know, I have some sympathy for those voices that kind of suggest that kind of the way that things operate in secondary education doesn't work any longer. So I think it's the same kind of point that you're making. So we're asking people to go into a situation that itself is dysfunctional, you know, and that might be part of the problem. So the idea that you spend your week with 25, 30 children in a single classroom with maybe 1, 2, 3 support staff in there and with close involvement from parents in whatever way that you want to control that, and you take those youngsters at least for a year, sometimes it might be longer in small schools, on a learning journey, seems to work as a concept. And the foundation phase works off that. It works off that kind of basis, and presumably the curriculum for Wales will work off that kind of basis. The idea then that you send children 3 months later into a situation where they've got 14 different teachers, and you know, not to spell it out because you know exactly what I mean, is one that I think on all sorts of levels seems to be, and we shouldn't overstate it because, you know, there are some very, very strong secondary schools and lots of youngsters who thrive in secondary education. But I think for a lot of schools and a lot of youngsters, it's a very challenging process. And that's why the issues around attendance, behaviour, all those things, I think, they're not new issues, but they're very prominent issues at the moment. And they're not, again, just confined to secondary, but they are far worse in secondary. So I think it could be, as I've said in relation to one of the main messages about this report, is that the system we have currently, and it's a systemic problem we have, recruitment, retention, that the system itself is part of the problem. But the system actually goes deeper because it could be the educational system in secondary education that is part of the problem. So, yeah, I mean, those, you see, can I develop that a little bit?
Yes.
Because you see, I think I've come to this point now, particularly after the very worthwhile launch event we had and the roundtable event we had last week, that I think there are three things here which need to be thought about going forward and where we need further research and where we need a lot of work. And they're all interrelated. I mean, the first is this thing about working conditions and workload. Because across the profession, possibly more so in primary even than in secondary, I think those are getting to a point now where it's extremely difficult to run the education service, you know? So what are we going to do about that? Well, I think, you know, people want to have a conversation there about AI.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking the
and
same.
And how AI can play into that. That's way beyond my ken. But people, I think, certainly believe that that can have a role to play. Mm-hmm. You know, if what you're trying to do is to go back to giving teachers the opportunity to teach, which is what I had when I went into teaching, it was basically teach, teach, teach. And if you're saying, right, that AI can help to reduce the bureaucratic workload, things outside of that teaching space, then that's got to be something you pick up on. We've got to be, I think, a bit more kind of, how can I put it? A bit more kind of reasonable in the expectations we have about how much change teachers can take on board, right? So clearly, and we're involved in the evaluation of the curriculum for Wales, I'm the PI for the Cardiff Met work in that area, so I'm not going to say too much about that because it's work in progress. But I think that these are early days, these are early stages, and people who want to kind of like say everything's wonderful and marvellous or no, this is a disaster, they're far too early. You know, I think Chairman Mao, wasn't it, was famously asked in the 1930s what he thought the effect of the French Revolution of 1789 had been. And he said it was far, far too early to say. And I think it's a bit like that with the curriculum of Wales. You know, I think we'll only know some way down the line as to where things are happening and where things are moving forward, curriculum for Wales. So I think we've got to give teachers time. ALN reform, curriculum for Wales, closing attainment gaps, whole school approach to emotional well, you know, we're loading more and more on schools. And I think we need to give schools breathing space if they're to manage all of that. So I think that plays into that workload, working conditions thing as well. I think this thing that really comes to the heart of what we started to talk about then, which is the way it's articulated often by head teachers, is we're becoming the fourth emergency service. Everything. So, you know, when I became a secondary teacher in the Rhondda, in a highly challenging post-industrial community, yeah, being the pastoral element of your job was there, you know, but it was an element of your job. Now, if you talk to primary teachers and secondary teachers, so often they say, basically, we are a little different to children's workers or social workers or family workers. And so I think we've got to really start thinking about how we can get much better support around our schools for all those things that are absolutely necessary to support children and families so that they can be ready, as it were, to do the learning and teaching bit. So that's got to be part of the conversation as well. And then the thing about flexibility. That like everybody else, and this isn't teachers saying I want to work from home 5 days a week or 4 days a week or 3 days a week or whatever, but it's about having more flexibility, and we point to that in the report. And there's some very interesting work going on in that area. So I think that whole thing about workload and working conditions that plays into a lot of the conversation that we've been having is something that now needs to really be grappled with. Mm. Otherwise, we're never going to make our profession more attractive.
Yeah, following on from that, if I were to be permitted to put my most cynical hat on, which is worn almost...
It's a tatty old hat.
Cynical hat, yeah. My least cynical hat is still pristine, but still got the tags on. But when you talk about these things, I mean, I'm struck by the fact that the report has not held back in making some really ambitious... recommendations for initial teacher education, and it has made some really ambitious recommendations, not so much for dropping more change on teachers, as you rightly say, they really don't need any more of that, but for reforming just the nature of the working conditions of the profession, those working conditions, that talent development, all of that kind of thing. And when I'm in my more cynical moments, I can't fail to notice that when policymakers want to effect a quick and easy change as they see it in the profession, they poke ITE with a sharp stick and hope it will filter through into the profession a bit more quickly. So I suppose the question that leads me to ask, especially given it's a whole 7 years since we've had the last ITE reform, is to what extent is there a danger that policymakers will jump on the bits that involve changing ITE and conveniently forget about the much, much more difficult bits that are about reforming the nature of the profession which follows on from ITE?
Well, that would be a massive missed opportunity, wouldn't it? Because, you know, reforming ITE may mean that we have, you know, better provision than we have currently, more attractive provision than we have currently. But unless you see this in terms of the long, thin development process, then I think, you know, again, you're just using sticking plaster, you know? So the two strands of work that I think need to take place alongside each other, as I've described, is trying to make this a more kind of workable profession, and everything that we've said about workload and working conditions and the expectations we have about school. Now, that needs to be, you know, a strand of work. It's almost like a project management piece of work that needs to be taken forward. Parallel to that needs to be how, from the knowledge that we have already, and we've got a lot of knowledge about that, can we ensure this long, thin teacher education and development to create the high quality teaching workforce that we want? And unless those two things happen in parallel, if they go for one bit of the workload development thing and just the IT bit, then I think they're missing the point. And I think that's probably where we are. I think probably there's an acceptance of that. The two things are absolutely critical. But it's not just about tinkering with ITE. I've said many, many times in this conversation that we don't want to throw babies out with bathwater, but we do want to ensure really that, you know, what we have enables that baby to stay in the bath, but to get out sometime. I'm going to push this too far now, and then take first steps. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, really be a comfort. You know, it's that kind of almost development process that you want for children, that you want for the profession.
And I suppose with my mentoring hat on here, you'd need running concurrently with that quite a robust and progressive mentoring and coaching dimension to the profession.
Absolutely, yeah.
That would support, because what I know from my research is that it is different mentoring student teachers compared with NQTs, compared with teachers who've been in the profession for a long time. I know you mentioned Finland in the report, and because they've got a master's level program, 5 years to train to be a teacher, they trust their mentors at that point to work collaboratively. Mm. It's facilitated, but through a process of collaborative, cooperative development together, because they know that they know enough by that point. Mm. But we do have some national approaches to, you know, certainly it's on a lot of schools' agendas to make sure that they've got some sort of approach to coaching. I think we're starting to move away from a more punitive teacher development process in schools. But I'm not sure that we're quite there with this sort of progression from, you know, being a mentor of a student teacher to what does that look like when they're in their early career teaching years? What does that look like when they get to a head teacher? How do head teachers get coached? And, you know, what does that look like? And I wonder if that concurrent sort of track and making that really appealing, making it a really viable career progression option to develop as a mentor, as a coach, you know, I wonder, you know, where are we at with that, and what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's got to be part of the conversation. And I, as I said earlier, I think I can't remember that I said it when we were on air or before when we were having our primary discussion. I think a lot of our schools are up for that, you know. They're up for actually saying, look, we don't just want to work with you in partnership in developing our future teachers for a year or 3 years. We want to work with you so that we can keep on working with you and developing them, because it's the randomness of what's in place at the moment. And I think that that does contrast, and we make the point in the report, it does contrast with what you see. And I don't particularly want to get into, well, England have got academy chains, we haven't, because we don't have academy chains, and we're not going to have academy chains, you know, that's settled, that's done. But when you look at the experience over there and you talk to colleagues of ours here who've worked in those academy chains, that's the talent management approach that they have. And I spoke to two senior staff from an academy school last week at a conference I was in Birmingham. And they're over the bridge in Cirencester. And they said, come over and see, because they have recruitment problems, but what they do is ensure that through various ways, and some of those have been unqualified, you know, that's going to be a challenge to them now that Bridget Phillipson is saying, no, all teachers will be qualified. But what they have done is to ensure that they try and find people who they think have the promise to be the teachers they want them to be, but then they work with them, you know, in this very rich process of development. Part and parcel of that is making mentoring and coaching the right type of coaching, because I understand the reservations that people like Trevor Mutton and Emma Jane Milton, who enunciated that in the conversation we were in, has about this is not teaching, this is not Doug Lemoff, this is not teaching to the book, you know, this is coaching in the sense of, look, you know, I've got to this point now where I'm regarded as being a coach in my school or an excellent teacher, because I think we should be giving teachers the opportunity to get that nomenclature of being an excellent teacher. We've been shy of that in Wales. It's about learn from me. Mm-hmm. Don't do what I do, but learn from, you know, the kind of experience that I have. And I finished last week by saying that these in the piece that I did in the launch, by saying, well, these two kind of numbers have been in my head a lot recently, 50 and 25. And the 50 is that I've been around these issues for 50 years, you know, that's how long I've been involved in these issues, ever since I became a teacher. And it's the same issues all the time that you come back to. So we make some progress over that period of time. But then the 25 is the 25 years of devolution. And I just do not think we have grasped this enough, you know? I think we've done some very interesting and exciting things over those 25 years. But I think we've almost assumed that that would be enough to take the teaching profession with us. But it hasn't been. And I think that's where the focus needs to be now. And that can't be just about, oh, we'll do a tweak here with the, you know, with the PGC programs we have, or we'll introduce a kind of employment-based route, although, you know, that's very, very welcome, and we've been very pleased to have that outcome. It can't be about that. It's got to be about that long, thin process of teacher education and development, and ensuring that what we do and what the schools that we work with do are part of that seamless kind of process. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, just to start to draw this to a close, you've already sort of taken some steps. The report is published. You've had this roundtable discussion. You've had a whole day of those talks. And What are you hoping to see change in the short term? What are you hoping will happen? Because oftentimes these reports get published and then we have a sort of period of sort of stagnation where you sort of think, well, did that just fall on deaf ears? So in the short term, what would you like to see come from this?
Yeah, it's like, again, Lawrence Kuban, the American educationist thing, isn't it? About, you know, on the surface, everything is kind of, you know, there's kind of storms and there's kind of tsunamis and everything is volatile. And then below the surface, on the ocean floor, it's completely calm. You know, well, we don't want everything that is being raised about these issues at the moment to be like that tsunami and nothing to change. Otherwise, I don't think the future is very bright. I think it's interesting, isn't it? You do get, I'm an historian, you do get moments in time where things move in the same direction. So we've been doing this work. The OECD have been doing a major piece of work in this area, of which Wales is a part. That report will be published towards the end of this month, I think. The Assembly Committee is beginning an inquiry into this area, and I'm sort of attached to that. So they will look into it. They've already looked into the Welsh language aspect of it and produced a previous report. They're going to look more broadly at these issues now. And the Cabinet Secretary for Education has recently announced that there will be this workforce development review, which we're not entirely clear about yet in terms of what that will embrace. But all these things are in the same space. Mm-hmm. So hopefully they will be brought together in some kind of policy development that will involve the whole profession, take on board the kind of evidence that we've been talking about, explore all sorts of areas that yet are not explored as fully as they should be. Because like all research, we've thrown up as many kind of issues really that need further exploration as we've kind of concluded on things. And I think in reality, therefore, it was a point made by the senior Welsh government official who was in the conversation last week. All of this is going to end up on the desk, whatever comes out of it, of the new education secretary, in other words, following the next Senate elections, because that's just the timescales. This work will go on through 2025 that I've described. Senate elections will be coming along in 2026. So nothing is going to change in the short term. Mm. I would have to wait and see. Because in the end, I think it's only the politicians who can grasp this and sort it and give a sense of direction mm-hmm. and provide. So somebody said last week in the conversation as well, again, very experienced policy civil servant, but somebody who's worked in HE as well. You need three things to bring about this transformational change. First of all, you need the thinking. He was very complimentary about the report and said the report, along with other things, will have done the thinking. You then need the legislation. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like Curriculum for Wales, this. You then need the legislation. I'm not sure how you'd entirely legislate in this area, but I think it's quite interesting to think that you might need to do that, and then you need the funding. Because you don't duck the issue in the report that if this ambition is to be fulfilled and if we're to turn this around, then we've got to start putting far more funding into education. But I'll finish with another aphorism, which I finished with last week. As a kind of, I like to think of myself as a public intellectual, as somebody who is always wanting to take my work out into the public arena. I'm always reminded that Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian Marxist and philosopher, once said that the public intellectual should have a pessimism, as it were, of the intellect, but an optimism of the will. And I think the picture at the moment, as we've discussed it in this podcast, is pretty pessimistic, you know. And I think, you know, we need to be real about that and face up to that. But there is nothing there, the optimism of the will, that we can't move forward, we can't turn around, because what we're talking about, after all, is giving our children the very best opportunities but also creating a better society. Mm. Because, yeah, I don't need to tell you this. You know, we all believe that education can be that powerhouse for the better society that we want in Wales.
Professor David Egan, you've been once again very generous with your time. You've done a public service with your intellect. I think in lieu of our short slots, I think we ought to just tell the listeners where they can find this report.
Yeah, there is a link to it. There's a link to it that through Cardiff Met.
So we will share that.
Yeah, you can pop it in the notes. Yeah, there is a link. I can share the link with you. Mm-hmm. We've established that for the launch, yeah.
So I suppose the last thing to say is thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
No doubt we'll be in your inbox at some point in the future asking you to come on again. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
Au revoir.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Thanks to Professor David Egan from Cardiff Met for joining us today to talk about his research. You can find a link to the report in the show notes for this episode. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lamburn and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.